The same wall said, "Viva my husband, who was the mayor of this village." And I hoped they would shoot me too, and I was going to say, "Viva la República y vivan mis padres." But instead there was no shooting, but instead the doing of the things. Listen, I will tell thee of one thing since it affects us. After the shooting of the Matadero, they took us, those relatives who had seen it but were not shot, back from the Matadero up the steep hill into the main square of the town. Nearly all were weeping, but some were numb with what they had seen, and the tears had dried in them. I myself could not cry. I did not notice anything that passed, for I could only see my father and my mother at the moment of the shooting, and my mother saying, "Long live my husband, who was mayor of this village," and this was in my head like a scream that would not die but kept on and on. For my mother was not a Republican, and she would not say Viva la República, but only Viva my father, who lay there, on his face, by her feet. But what she had said very loud, like a shriek. And then they shot, and she fell, and I tried to leave the line to go to her, but we were all tied. The shooting was done by the Guardia Civil, and they were still there waiting to shoot more when the phalangists herded us away and up the hill, leaving the Guardia Civiles leaning on their rifles and leaving all the bodies there against the wall. We were tied by the wrists in a long line of girls and women, and they herded us up by the hill and through the streets to the square, and in the square they stopped in front of the barber shop, which was across the square from the city hall. Then the two men looked at us, and one said, "That is the daughter of the mayor," and the other said, "Commence with her." Then they cut the rope that was on each of my wrists, one saying to others of them, "Tie up the line," and these two took me by the arms and into the barber shop, and lifted me up and put me in the barber's chair, and held me there. I saw my face in the mirror of the barber shop, and the faces of those who were holding me, and the faces of three others who were leaning over me. And I knew none of their faces, but in the glass I saw myself and them, but they saw only me. And it was as though one were in the dentist's chair, and there were many dentists, and they were all insane. My own face I could hardly recognize because my grief had changed it, but I looked at it and knew that it was me. But my grief was so great that I had no fear, nor any feeling but my grief. At that time I wore my hair in two braids, and as I watched in the mirror, one of them lifted one of my braids and pulled on it so it hurt me suddenly through my grief, and then cut it off, close to my head with a razor. And I saw myself with one braid and a slash where the other had been. Then he cut off the other braid, but without pulling on it, and the razor made a small cut on my ear, and I saw blood come from it. Canst thou feel the scar with thy finger? Yes. But would it be better not to talk of this? This is nothing. I will not talk of that which is bad. So he had cut both braids close to my head with a razor, and the others laughed, and I did not even feel the cut on my ear. And then he stood in front of me and struck me across the face with the braids, while the other two held me, and he said, "This is how we make red nuns. This will show thee how to unite with thy proletarian brothers, bride of the Red Christ." And he struck me again and again across the face with the braids which had been mine, and then he put the two of them in my mouth and tied them tight around my neck, knotting them in the back to make a gag, and the two holding me laughed. And all of them who saw it laughed, and when I saw them laugh in the mirror I commenced to cry, because until then I had been too frozen in myself from the shooting to be able to cry. Then the one who had gagged me ran a clippers all over my head, first from the forehead all the way to the back of the neck, and then across the top, and then all over my head, and close behind my ears, and they held me so I could see into the glass of the barber's mirror all the time that they did this, and I could not believe it as I saw it done, and I cried, but I could not look away from the horror that my face made, with the mouth open, and the braids tied in it, and my head coming naked under the clippers. And when the one with the clippers was finished, he took a bottle of iodine from the shelf of the barber. They had shot the barber too, for he belonged to a syndicate, and he lay in the doorway of the shop, and they had lifted me over him as they brought me in. And with the glass wand that is in the iodine bottle, he touched me on the ear where it had been cut, and the small pain of that came through my grief and through my horror. Then he stood in front of me and wrote UHP on my forehead with the iodine, lettering it slowly and carefully as though he were an artist. And I saw all of this as it happened in the mirror, and I no longer cried, for my heart was frozen in me for my father and my mother, and what happened to me now was nothing, and I knew it. Then when he had finished the lettering, the phalangist stepped back and looked at me to examine his work, and then he put down the iodine bottle and picked up the clippers and said, "Next." And they took me out of the barber shop, holding me tight by each arm, and I stumbled over the barber lying there still in the doorway on his back with his gray face up. And we nearly collided with Concepcion Garcia, my best friend, that two of them were bringing in, and when she saw me, she did not recognize me. And then she recognized me and she screamed, and I could hear her screaming all the time they were shoving me across the square and into the doorway and up the stairs of the city hall and into the office of my father where they laid me onto the couch. And it was there that the bad things were done. "My rabbit," Robert Jordan said, and held her as close and as gently as he could, but he was as full of hate as any man could be. "Do not talk more about it. Do not tell me any more, for I cannot bear my hatred now." She was stiff and cold in his arms, and she said, "Nay, I will never talk more of it. But they are bad people, and I would like to kill some of them with thee if I could. But I have told thee this only for thy pride if I am to be thy wife, so thou wouldst understand." "I am glad you told me," he said, "for tomorrow, with luck, we will kill plenty."
"But will we kill phalangists? It was they who did it."
"They do not fight," he said gloomily. "They kill at the rear. It is not them we fight in battle."
"But can we not kill them in some way? I would like to kill some very much."
"I have killed them," he said, "and we will kill them again. At the trains we have killed them."
"I would like to go for a train with thee," Maria said. "The time of the train that Pilar brought me back from, I was somewhat crazy. Did she tell thee how I was?"
"Yes, do not talk of it."
"I was dead in my head with a numbness, and all I could do was cry. But there is another thing that I must tell thee. This I must. Then perhaps thou wilt not marry me. But Roberto, if thou should not wish to marry me, can we not then just be always together?"
"I will marry thee."
"Nay, I had forgotten this. Perhaps you should not. It is possible that I can never bear thee either a son or a daughter, for the Pilar says that if I could, it would have happened to me with the things which were done. I must tell thee that. Oh, I do not know why I had forgotten that."
"It is of no importance, Rabbit," he said. "First, it may not be true. That is for a doctor to say. Then, I would not wish to bring either a son or a daughter into this world, as this world is. And also, you take all the love I have to give."
"I would like to bear thy son and thy daughter," she told him. "And how can the world be made better if there are no children of us who fight against the fascists?"
"Thou," he said, "I love thee. Hearest thou? And now we must sleep, Rabbit, for I must be up long before daylight, and the dawn comes early in this month."
"Then it is all right about the last thing I said? We can still be married?"
"We are married now. I marry thee now. Thou art my wife. But go to sleep, my rabbit, for there is little time now."
"And we will truly be married? Not just a talking?"
"Truly."
"Then I will sleep, and think of that if I wake."
"I too."
"Good night, my husband."
"Good night," he said. "Good night, wife."
He heard her breathing steadily and regularly now, and he knew she was asleep, and he lay awake and very still, not wanting to waken her by moving. He thought of all the part she had not told him, and he lay there hating, and he was pleased there would be killing in the morning. "But I must not take any of it personally," he thought. "Though how can I keep from it? I know that we did dreadful things to them too, but it was because we were uneducated and knew no better. But they did that on purpose and deliberately. Those who did that are the last flowering of what their education has produced. Those are the flowers of Spanish chivalry. What a people they have been. What sons of bitches, from Cortez, Pizarro, Menéndez de Avila, all down through Enrique Lister to Pablo. And what wonderful people. There is no finer and no worse people in the world, no kinder people and no crueler. And who understands them? Not me, because if I did, I would forgive it all. To understand is to forgive. That's not true. Forgiveness has been exaggerated. Forgiveness is a Christian idea, and Spain has never been a Christian country. It has always had its own special idol worship within the church. otra virgen más. I suppose that was why they had to destroy the virgins of their enemies. Surely it was deeper with them, with the Spanish religion fanatics, than it was with the people. The people had grown away from the church because the church was in the government, and the government had always been rotten. This was the only country that the Reformation never reached. They were paying for the Inquisition now, all right. Well, it was something to think about, something to keep your mind from worrying about your work. It was sounder than pretending. God, he had done a lot of pretending tonight, and Pilar had been pretending all day, sure. What if they were killed tomorrow? What did it matter as long as they did the bridge properly? That was all they had to do tomorrow. It didn't. You couldn't do these things indefinitely, but you weren't supposed to live forever. Maybe I have had all my life in 3 days, he thought. If that's true, I wish we would have spent the last night differently. But last nights are never any good. Last nothings are any good. Yes, last words were good sometimes. Viva my husband, who was mayor of this town, was good. He knew it was good because it made a tingle run all over him when he said it to himself. He leaned over and kissed Maria, who did not wake. In English, he whispered very quietly, I'd like to marry you, Rabbit. I'm very proud of your family. Chapter 32. On that same night in Madrid, there were many people at the Hotel Gaylord. A car pulled up under the porte cochere of the hotel, its headlights painted over with blue calcimine, and a little man in black riding boots, gray riding breeches, and a short, gray, high-buttoned jacket stepped out and returned the salute of the two sentries as he opened the door, nodded to the secret policeman who sat at the concierge's desk, and stepped into the elevator. There were two sentries seated on chairs inside the door, one on each side of the marble entrance hall, and these only looked up as the little man passed them at the door of the elevator. It was their business to feel everyone they did not know along the flanks, under the armpits, and over the hip pockets to see if the person entering carried a pistol, and if he did, have him check it with the concierge. But they knew the short man in riding boots very well, and they hardly looked up as he passed. The apartment where he lived in Gaylord's was crowded as he entered. People were sitting and standing about and talking together as in any drawing room, and the men and the women were drinking vodka, whiskey and soda, and beer from small glasses filled from great pitchers. Four of the men were in uniform. The others wore windbreakers or leather jackets, and three of the four women were dressed in ordinary street dresses, while the fourth, who was haggardly thin and dark, wore a sort of severely cut militia woman's uniform, with a skirt with high boots under it. When he came into the room, Karkov went at once to the woman in the uniform, and bowed to her and shook hands. She was his wife, and he said something to her in Russian that no one could hear, and for a moment the insolence that had been in his eyes as he entered the room was gone. Then it lighted again, as he saw the mahogany-colored head and the love-lazy face of the well-constructed girl who was his mistress, and he strode with short, precise steps over to her and bowed and shook her hand in such a way that no one could tell it was not a mimicry of his greeting to his wife. His wife had not looked after him as he walked across the room. She was standing with a tall, good-looking Spanish officer, and they were talking Russian now. "Your great love is getting a little fat," Karkov was saying to the girl. "All of our heroes are fattening now as we approach the second year." He did not look at the man he was speaking of. "You are so ugly you would be jealous of a toad," the girl told him cheerfully. She spoke in German. "Can I go with thee to the offensive tomorrow?"
"No, nor is there one."
"Everyone knows about it," the girl said. "Don't be so mysterious. Dolores is going. I will go with her or Carmen. Many people are going."
"Go with whoever will take you," Karkov said. "I will not."
Then he turned to the girl and asked seriously, "Who told thee of it? Be exact." "Richard," she said, as seriously. Karkov shrugged his shoulders and left her standing. Karkov, a man of middle height with a gray, heavy, sagging face, puffed eye pouches and a pendulous underlip, called to him in a dyspeptic voice,
"Have you heard the good news?"
Karkov went over to him and the man said,
"I only have it now, not 10 minutes ago. It is wonderful. All day the fascists have been fighting among themselves near Segovia. They have been forced to quell the mutinies with automatic rifle and machine gun fire. In the afternoon they were bombing their own troops with planes."
"Yes?" asked Karkov.
That is true, the puffy-eyed man said. Dolores brought the news herself. She was here with the news and was in such a state of radiant exultation as I have never seen. The truth of the news shone from her face. That great face, he said happily.
That great face, Karkov said, with no tone in his voice at all.
If you could have heard her, the puffy-eyed man said. The news itself shone from her with a light that was not of this world. In her voice you could tell the truth of what she said. I am putting it in an article for Izvestia. It was one of the greatest moments of the war to me, when I heard the report in that great voice, where pity, compassion, and truth are blended. Goodness and truth shine from her as from a true saint of the people. Not for nothing is she called La Passionaria.
Not for nothing, Karkov said in a dull voice. You better write it for Izvestia now, before you forget that last beautiful lead.
That is a woman that is not to joke about, not even by a cynic like you, the puffy-eyed man said. If you could have been here to hear her and see her face.
That great voice, Karkov said, that great face. Write it, he said. Don't tell it to me. Don't waste whole paragraphs on me. Go and write it now.
Not just now.
I think you'd better, Karkov said, and looked at him, and then looked away.
The puffy-eyed man stood there a couple of minutes more, holding his glass of vodka, his eyes, puffy as they were, absorbed in the beauty of what he had seen and heard, and then he left the room to write it. Karkov went over to another man of about 48, who was short, chunky, jovial-looking, with pale blue eyes, thinning blonde hair, and a gay mouth under a bristly yellow mustache. This man was in uniform. He was a divisional commander, and he was a Hungarian.
"Were you here when the Dolores was here?" Karkov asked the man. "Yes."
"What was the stuff?"
"Something about the fascists fighting among themselves. Beautiful, if true.
You hear much talk of tomorrow?"
"Scandalous. All the journalists should be shot, as well as most of the people in this room, and certainly the intriguing German unmentionable of a Richard. Whoever gave that Sunday Fugler command of a brigade should be shot. Perhaps you and me should be shot, too."
It is possible, the general laughed. Don't suggest it, though.
That is a thing I never like to talk about, Karkov said. That American who comes here sometimes is over there. You know that one, Jordan, who is with the Partisan group? He is there where this business they spoke of is supposed to happen.
Well, he should have a report through on it tonight, then, the general said. They don't like me down there, or I'd go down and find out for you. He works with Goltz on this, doesn't he? You'll see Goltz tomorrow.
Early tomorrow.
Keep out of his way until it's going well, the general said. He hates you bastards as much as I do, though he has a much better temper.
But about this,
it was probably the fascists having maneuvers, the general grinned.
Well, we'll see if Goltz can maneuver them a little.
Let Goltz try his hand at it.
We maneuvered them at Guadalajara.
I hear you are traveling too, Karkov said, showing his bad teeth as he smiled.
The general was suddenly angry.
And me too. Now is the mouth on me. And on all of us always. This filthy sewing circle of gossip. One man who could keep his mouth shut could save the country if he believed he could.
Your friend Prieto can keep his mouth shut.
But he doesn't believe he can win. How can you win without belief in the people?
You decide that, Karkov said. I am going to get a little sleep.
He left the smoky, gossip-filled room and went into the back bedroom and sat down on the bed and pulled his boots off. He could still hear them talking, so he shut the door and opened the window. He did not bother to undress because at 2 o'clock he would be starting for the drive by Colmenar, Cerceda, and Navacerrada up to the front where Goltz would be attacking in the morning.
Chapter 33 It was 2 o'clock in the morning when Pilar waked him. As her hand touched him, he thought at first it was Maria, and he rolled toward her and said, "Rabbit." Then the woman's big hand shook his shoulder, and he was suddenly, completely and absolutely awake, and his hand was around the butt of the pistol that lay alongside of his bare right leg, and all of him was as cocked as the pistol, with its safety catch slipped off. In the dark he saw it was Pilar, and he looked at the dial of his wristwatch with the two hands shining in the short angle close to the top, and seeing it was only 2, he said, "What passes with thee, woman?"
"Pablo is gone," the big woman said to him.
Robert Jordan put on his trousers and shoes. Maria had not waked.
When? He asked.
It must be an hour.
And?
He has taken something of thine, the woman said miserably.
So? What?
I do not know, she told him. Come and see.
In the dark, they walked over to the entrance of the cave, ducked under the blanket, and went in. Robert Jordan followed her, in the dead ashes, bad air, and sleeping men smell of the cave, shining his electric torch so that he would not step on any of those who were sleeping on the floor. Anselmo woke and said,
Is it time?
No, Robert Jordan whispered.
Sleep, old one.
The two sacks were at the head of Pilar's bed, which was screened off with a hanging blanket from the rest of the cave. The bed smelt stale and sweat-dried and sickly sweet the way an Indian's bed does, as Robert Jordan knelt on it and shone the torch on the two sacks. There was a long slit from top to bottom in each one. Holding the torch in his left hand, Robert Jordan felt in the first sack with his right hand. This was the one that he carried his robe in, and it should not be very full. It was not very full. There was some wire in it still, but the square wooden box of the exploder was gone. So was the cigar box with the carefully wrapped and packed detonators. So was the screw-top tin with the fuse and the caps. Robert Jordan felt in the other sack. It was still full of explosive. There might be one packet missing. He stood up and turned to the woman. There is a hollow, empty feeling that a man can have when he is waked too early in the morning that is almost like the feeling of disaster, and he had this multiplied 1,000 times.
And this is what you call guarding one's materials? He said. I slept with my head against them, and one arm touching them, Pilar told him.
You slept well.
Listen, the woman said. He got up in the night, and I said, Where do you go, Pablo? To urinate, woman, he told me, and I slept again. When I woke again, I did not know what time had passed, but I thought when he was not there that he had gone down to look at the horses, as was his custom.
Then, she finished miserably,
when he did not come, I worried, and when I worried, I felt of the sacks to be sure all was well, and there were the slit places, and I came to thee.
Come on, Robert Jordan said. They were outside now, and it was still so near the middle of the night that you could not feel the morning coming. Can he get out with the horses other ways than by the sentry?
Two ways.
Who's at the top?
Eladio.
Robert Jordan said nothing more until they reached the meadow where the horses were staked out to feed. There were three horses feeding in the meadow. The big bay and the gray were gone. How long ago do you think it was he left you?
It must have been an hour.
And that is that, Robert Jordan said. I go to get what is left of my sacks and go back to bed.
I will guard them.
Kewa, you will guard them. You've guarded them once already.
Ingles,
the woman said.
I feel in regard to this as you do. There is nothing I would not do to bring back thy property. You have no need to hurt me. We have both been betrayed by Pablo.
As she said this, Robert Jordan realized that he could not afford the luxury of being bitter, that he could not quarrel with this woman. He had to work with this woman on that day that was already 2 hours and more gone. He put his hand on her shoulder.
It is nothing, Pilar, he told her.
What is gone is of small importance. We shall improvise something that will do as well.
But what did he take?
Nothing, woman. Some luxuries that one permits oneself.
Was it part of thy mechanism for the exploding?
Yes. But there are other ways to do the exploding.
Tell me, did Pablo not have caps and fuse? Surely they would have equipped him with those. He has taken them, she said miserably. I looked at once for them. They are gone, too.
They walked back through the woods to the entrance of the cave.
Get some sleep, he said.
We are better off with Pablo gone.
I go to see Eladio.
He will have gone another way.
I go anyway. I have betrayed thee with my lack of smartness.
Nay, he said. Get some sleep, woman. We must be under way at 4. He went into the cave with her and brought out the two sacks, carrying them together in both arms so that nothing could spill from the slits.
Let me sew them up.
Before we start, he said softly, I take them not against you, but so that I can sleep.
I must have them early to sew them.
You shall have them early, he told her. Get some sleep, woman.
Nay, she said, I have failed thee, and I have failed the Republic.
Get thee some sleep, woman, he told her gently. Get thee some sleep. Chapter 34 The fascists held the crests of the hills here. Then there was a valley that no one held except for a fascist post in a farmhouse with its outbuildings and its barn that they had fortified. Andres, on his way to Goltz with the message from Robert Jordan, made a wide circle around this post in the dark. He knew where there was a tripwire laid that fired a set gun, and he located it in the dark, stepped over it, and started along the small stream bordered with poplars whose leaves were moving with the night wind. A cock crowed at the farmhouse that was the fascist post, and as he walked along the stream he looked back and saw, through the trunks of the poplars, a light showing at the lower edge of one of the windows of the farmhouse. The night was quiet and clear, and Andres left the stream and struck across the meadow. There were four haycocks in the meadow that had stood there ever since the fighting in July of the year before. No one had ever carried the hay away, and the four seasons that had passed had flattened the cocks and made the hay worthless. Andres thought what a waste it was as he stepped over a tripwire that ran between two of the haycocks. But the Republicans would have had to carry the hay up the steep Guadarrama slope that rose beyond the meadow, and the fascists did not need it, I suppose, he thought. They have all the hay they need, and all the grain. They have much, he thought. But we will give them a blow tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning we will give them something for Sordo. What barbarians they are. But in the morning there will be dust on the road. He wanted to get this message taken over and be back for the attack on the posts in the morning. Did he really want to get back, though? Or did he only pretend he wanted to be back? He knew the reprieved feeling he had felt when the Inglés had told him he was to go with the message. He had faced the prospect of the morning calmly. It was what was to be done. He had voted for it, and would do it. The wiping out of Sordo had impressed him deeply. But after all, that was Sordo. That was not them. What they had to do, they would do. But when the Inglés had spoken to him of the message, he had felt the way he used to feel when he was a boy, and he had wakened in the morning of the festival of his village and heard it raining hard so that he knew that it would be too wet and that the bull baiting in the square would be cancelled. He loved the bull baiting when he was a boy, and he looked forward to it, and to the moment when he would be in the square in the hot sun and the dust with the carts ranged all around to close the exits and to make a closed place into which the bull would come, sliding down out of his box, breaking with all 4 feet when they pulled the end gate up. He looked forward with excitement, delight, and sweating fear to the moment when, in the square, he would hear the clatter of the bull's horns knocking against the wood of his traveling box, and then the sight of him as he came, sliding, breaking out into the square, his head up, his nostrils wide, his ears twitching, dust in the sheen of his black hide, dried crut splashed on his flanks, watching his eyes set wide apart, unblinking eyes under the widespread horns, as smooth and solid as driftwood polished by the sand, the sharp tips up-tilted, so that to see them did something to your heart. He looked forward all the year to that moment when the bull would come out into the square on that day, when you watched his eyes while he made his choice of whom in the square he would attack, in that sudden, head-lowering, horn-reaching, quick cat gallop that stopped your heart dead when it started. He had looked forward to that moment all the year when he was a boy. But the feeling when the Inglés gave the order about the message was the same as when you woke to hear the reprieve of the rain falling on the slate roof against the stone wall, and into the puddles on the dirt street of the village. He had always been very brave with the bull in those village capeas, as brave as any in the village, or of the other nearby villages, and not for anything would he have missed it any year, although he did not go to the capeas of other villages. He was able to wait still when the bull charged, and only jumped aside at the last moment. He waved a sack under his muzzle to draw him off when the bull had someone down, and many times he had held and pulled on the horns when the bull had someone on the ground, and pulled sideways on the horn, had slapped and kicked him in the face until he left the man to charge someone else. He had held the bull's tail to pull him away from a fallen man, bracing hard and pulling and twisting. Once he had pulled the tail around with one hand until he could reach a horn with the other. And when the bull had lifted his head to charge him, he had run backwards, circling with the bull, holding the tail in one hand and the horn in the other, until the crowd had swarmed onto the bull with their knives and stabbed him. In the dust and the heat, the shouting, the bull and man and wine smell, he had been the first of the crowd that threw themselves onto the bull, and he knew the feeling when the bull rocked and bucked under him, and he lay across the withers with one arm locked around the base of the horn and his hand holding the other horn tight. His fingers locked as his body tossed and wrenched, and his left arm felt as though it would tear from the socket while he lay on the hot, dusty, bristly, tossing slope of muscle, the ear clenched tight in his teeth, and drove his knife again and again and again into the swelling, tossing bulge of the neck that was now spouting hot on his fist as he let his weight hang on the high slope of the withers and banged into the neck. The first time he had bit the ear like that and held on to it, his neck and jaws stiffened against the tossing, they had all made fun of him afterwards. But though they joked him about it, they had great respect for him, and every year after that he had to repeat it. They called him the Bulldog of Villaconejos, and joked about him eating cattle raw. But everyone in the village looked forward to seeing him do it, and every year he knew that first the bull would come out, then there would be the charges and the tossing, and then when they yelled for the rush for the killing, he would place himself to rush through the other attackers and leap for his hold. Then when it was over, and the bull settled and sunk dead finally under the weight of the killers, he would stand up and walk away, ashamed of the ear part, but also as proud as a man could be. And he would go through the carts to wash his hands at the stone fountain, and men would clap him on the back and hand him wineskins and say, "Hooray for you, bulldog! Long life to your mother!" Or they would say, "That's what it is to have a pair of cojones, year after year." Andres would be ashamed, empty feeling, proud and happy, and he would shake them all off and wash his hands and his right arm and wash his knife well, and then take one of the wineskins and rinse the ear taste out of his mouth for that year, spitting the wine on the stone flags of the plaza before he lifted the wineskin high and let the wine spurt into the back of his mouth. Surely, he was the bulldog of Villaconejos, and not for anything would he have missed doing it each year in his village. But he knew there was no better feeling than that one the sound of the rain gave when he knew he would not have to do it. "But I must go back," he told himself. "There is no question but that I must go back for the affair of the posts and the bridge. My brother Eladio is there, who is of my own bone and flesh. Anselmo, Primitivo, Fernando, Augustine, Rafael, though clearly he is not serious, the two women, Pablo and the Inglés, though the Inglés does not count since he is a foreigner and under orders. They are all in for it. It is impossible that I should escape this proving through the accident of a message. I must deliver this message now quickly and well, and then make all haste to return in time for the assault on the posts. It would be ignoble of me not to participate in this action because of the accident of this message. That could not be clearer. And besides," he told himself, as one who suddenly remembers that there will be pleasure, too, in an engagement only the onerous aspects of which he has been considering, "and besides, I will enjoy the killing of some fascists. It has been too long since we have destroyed any. Tomorrow can be a day of much valid action. Tomorrow can be a day of concrete acts. Tomorrow can be a day which is worth something. That tomorrow should come, and that I should be there." Just then, as knee-deep in the gorse he climbed the steep slope that led to the Republican lines, a partridge flew up from under his feet, exploding in a whirr of wing beats in the dark, and he felt a sudden breath-stopping fright. "It is the suddenness," he thought. "How can they move their wings that fast? She must be nesting now. I probably trod close to the eggs. If there were not this war, I would tie a handkerchief to the bush and come back in the daytime and search out the nest, and I could take the eggs and put them under a setting hen, and when they hatched, we would have little partridges in the poultry yard, and I would watch them grow, and when they were grown, I'd use them for collars. I wouldn't blind them because they would be tame. Or do you suppose they would fly off? Probably. Then I would have to blind them. But I don't like to do that after I've raised them. I could clip the wings or tether them by one leg when I used them for calling. If there was no war, I would go with Eladio to get crayfish from that stream back there by the fascist post. One time we got 4 dozen from that stream in a day. If we go to the Sierra de Gredos, after this of the bridge, there are fine streams there for trout and for crayfish also. I hope we go to Gredos, he thought. We could make a good life in Gredos in the summertime and in the fall, but it would be terribly cold in winter. But by winter, maybe we will have won the war. If our father had not been a Republican, both Eladio and I would be soldiers now with the fascists. And if one were a soldier with them, then there would be no problem. One would obey orders, and one would live or die, and in the end it would be however it would be. It was easier to live under a regime than to fight it. But this irregular fighting was a thing of much responsibility. There was much worry if you were one to worry. Eladio thinks more than I do. Also, he worries. I believe truly in the cause, and I do not worry. But it is a life of much responsibility. I think that we are born into a time of great difficulty, he thought. I think any other time was probably easier. One suffers little, because all of us have been formed to resist suffering. They who suffer are unsuited to this climate. But it is a time of difficult decisions. The fascists attacked and made our decision for us. We fight to live. But I would like to have it so that I could tie a handkerchief to that bush back there, and come in the daylight, and take the eggs and put them under a hen, and be able to see the chicks of the partridge in my own courtyard. I would like such small and regular things. But you have no house, and no courtyard in your no house, he thought. You have no family but a brother who goes to battle tomorrow, and you own nothing but the wind and the sun and an empty belly. The wind is small, he thought, and there is no sun. You have 4 grenades in your pocket, but they are only good to throw away. You have a carbine on your back, but it is only good to give away bullets. You have a message to give away. And you're full of crap that you can give to the earth, he grinned in the dark. You can anoint it also with urine. Everything you have is to give. Thou art a phenomenon of philosophy, and an unfortunate man, he told himself, and grinned again. But for all his noble thinking a little while before, there was in him that reprieved feeling that had always come with the sound of rain in the village on the morning of the fiesta. Ahead of him now, at the top of the ridge, was the government position, where he knew he would be challenged.
Chapter 35. Robert Jordan lay in the robe beside the girl Maria, who was still sleeping. He lay on his side, turned away from the girl, and he felt her long body against his back, and the touch of it now was just an irony. You. You, he raged at himself. Yes, you. You told yourself the first time you saw him that when he would be friendly would be when the treachery would come. You damned fool. You utter, blasted, damned fool. Chuck all that. That's not what you have to do now. What are the chances that he hid them or threw them away? Not so good. Besides, you'd never find them in the dark. He would have kept them. He took some dynamite, too. Oh, the dirty, vile, treacherous sod. The dirty, rotten crut. Why couldn't he have just mucked off and not have taken the exploder and the detonators? Why was I such an utter goddamned fool as to leave them with that bloody woman? The smart, treacherous, ugly bastard. The dirty cabron. Cut it out and take it easy, he told himself. You had to take chances, and that was the best there was. You're just mucked, he told himself. You're mucked for good and higher than a kite. Keep your damned head and get the anger out and stop this cheap lamenting like a damned wailing wall. It's gone. God damn you, it's gone. Oh, damn the dirty swine to hell. You can muck your way out of it. You've got to. You know you've got to blow it if you have to stand there and... Cut out that stuff, too. Why don't you ask your grandfather? Oh, muck my grandfather, and muck this whole treacherous, muck-faced, mucking country and every mucking Spaniard in it, on either side, and to hell forever. Muck them to hell together. Largo, Prieto, Asensio, Miaja, Rojo, all of them. Muck every one of them to death to hell. Muck the whole treachery-ridden country. Muck their egotism and their selfishness, and their selfishness and their egotism, and their conceit and their treachery. Muck them to hell and always. Muck them before we die for them. Muck them after we die for them. Muck them to death and hell. God muck Pablo. Pablo is all of them. God pity the Spanish people. Any leader they have will muck them. One good man, Pablo Iglesias, in 2,000 years, and everybody else mucking them. How do we know how he would have stood up in this war? I remember when I thought Largo was okay. Durruti was good,
and his own people shot him there, at the Puente de los Franceses. Shot him because he wanted them to attack. Shot him in the glorious discipline of indiscipline. The cowardly swine. I'll muck them all to hell and be damned, and that Pablo that just mucked off with my exploder and my box of detonators, I'll muck him to deepest hell. But no, he's mucked us instead. They always muck you instead, from Cortez and Menendez de Avila, down to Miaja. Look at what Miaja did to Kleber, the bald, egotistical swine. The stupid, egg-headed bastard, muck all the insane, egotistical, treacherous swine that have always governed Spain and ruled her armies. Muck everybody but the people, and then be damned careful what they turn into when they have power. His rage began to thin as he exaggerated more and more and spread his scorn and contempt so widely and unjustly that he could no longer believe in it himself. If that were true, what are you here for? It's not true, and you know it. Look at all the good ones. Look at all the fine ones. He could not bear to be unjust. He hated injustice as he hated cruelty. And he lay in his rage that blinded his mind until gradually the anger died down, and the red, black, blinding, killing anger was all gone, and his mind now as quiet, empty, calm, and sharp, cold-seeing as a man is after he has had sexual intercourse with a woman that he does not love. And you poor rabbit, he leaned over and said to Maria, who smiled in her sleep and moved close against him, I would have struck thee there a while back if thou had spoken. What an animal a man is in a rage. He lay close to the girl now with his arms around her and his chin on her shoulder, and lying there he figured out exactly what he would have to do and how he would have to do it. And it isn't so bad, he thought. It really isn't so bad at all. I don't know whether anyone has ever done it before, but there will always be people who will do it from now on given a similar jam. If we do it, and if they hear about it. If they hear about it, yes. If they do not just wonder how it was we did it. We are too short of people, but there is no sense to worry about that. I will do the bridge with what we have. God, I'm glad I got over being angry. It was like not being able to breathe in a storm. That being angry is another damned luxury you can't afford. It's all figured out, Guapa, he said softly against Maria's shoulder. You haven't been bothered by any of it. You have not known about it. We'll be killed, but we'll blow the bridge. You have not had to worry about it. That isn't much of a wedding present. But is not a good night's sleep supposed to be priceless? You had a good night's sleep. See if you can wear that, like a ring on your finger. Sleep, Guapa. Sleep well, my beloved. I do not wake thee. That is all I can do for thee now. He lay there, holding her very lightly, feeling her breathe and feeling her heartbeat, and keeping track of the time on his wristwatch. Chapter 36. Andres had challenged at the government position. That is, he had lain down where the ground fell sharply away below the triple belt of wire and shouted up at the rock and earth parapet. There was no continual defensive line, and he could easily have passed this position in the dark and made his way farther into the government territory before running into someone who would challenge him. But it seemed safer and simpler to get it over here.
Salud! He had shouted. Salud, milicianos!
He heard a bolt snick as it was pulled back. Then, from farther down the parapet, a rifle fired. There was a crashing crack and a downward stab of yellow in the dark. Andres had flattened at the click, the top of his head hard against the ground.
Don't shoot, comrades! Andres shouted. Don't shoot! I want to come in! How many are you?
Someone called from behind the parapet.
One. Me, alone. Who are you? Andres Lopez of Villaconejos, from the band of Pablo, with a message.
Have you your rifle and equipment?
Yes, man.
We can take in none without rifle and equipment, the voice said. Nor in larger groups than three.
I am alone, Andres shouted. It is important. Let me come in.
He could hear them talking behind the parapet, but not what they were saying. Then the voice shouted again.
How many are you?
One. Me. Alone. For the love of God.
They were talking behind the parapet again. Then the voice came.
Listen, fascist.
I am not a fascist, Andres shouted. I am a guerrillero from the band of Pablo. I come with a message for the general staff.
He's crazy, he heard someone say. Toss a bomb at him.
Listen, Andres said. I am alone. I am completely by myself. I obscenity in the midst of the holy mysteries that I am alone. Let me come in.
He speaks like a Christian, he heard someone say, and laugh. Then someone else said,
The best thing is to toss a bomb down on him.
No, Andres shouted. That would be a great mistake. This is important. Let me come in.
It was for this reason that he had never enjoyed trips back and forth between the lines. Sometimes it was better than others, but it was never good.
You are alone?
The voice called down again.
Me cago en la leche, Andres shouted. How many times must I tell thee? I am alone.
Then if you should be alone, stand up and hold thy rifle over thy head. Andres stood up and put the carbine above his head, holding it in both hands.
Now come through the wire. We have thee covered with the máquina,
the voice called. Andres was in the first zigzag belt of wire.
I need my hands to get through the wire, he shouted. Keep them up,
the voice commanded.
I am held fast by the wire, Andres called.
It would have been simpler to have thrown a bomb at him, a voice said.
Let him sling his rifle, another voice said. He cannot come through there with his hands above his head. Use a little reason.
All these fascists are the same, the other voice said. They demand one condition after another.
Listen, Andres shouted. I am no fascist, but a guerrillero from the band of Pablo. We've killed more fascists than the typhus.
I have never heard of the band of Pablo, the man who was evidently in command of the post said. Neither of Peter, nor of Paul, nor of any of the other saints nor apostles, nor of their bands. Sling thy rifle over thy shoulder, and use thy hands to come through the wire.
Before we loose the máquina on thee, another shouted. Que poco amable sois,
Andres said.
You're not very amiable.
He was working his way through the wire.
Amables, someone shouted at him. We are in a war, man. It begins to appear so, Andres said. What's he say?
Andres heard a bolt click again.
Nothing, he shouted. I say nothing. Do not shoot until I get through this fornicating wire.
Don't speak badly of our wire, someone shouted, or we'll toss a bomb on you.
Quiero decir, qué buena alambrada, Andres shouted.
What beautiful wire, God in a latrine, what lovely wire. Soon I will be with thee, brothers.
Throw a bomb at him, he heard the one voice say.
I tell you, that's the soundest way to deal with the whole thing. Brothers, Andres said.
He was wet through with sweat, and he knew the bomb advocate was perfectly capable of tossing a grenade at any moment.
I have no importance.
I believe it, the bomb man said.
You are right, Andres said.
He was working carefully through the third belt of wire, and he was very close to the parapet.
I have no importance of any kind, but the affair is serious. Muy, muy serio.
There is no more serious thing than liberty, the bomb man shouted.
Thou thinkest there is anything more serious than liberty?
He asked challengingly.
No, man, Andres said, relieved.
He knew now he was up against the crazies, the ones with the black and red scarves.
Viva la libertad!
Viva la FAI! Viva la CNT!
They shouted back at him from the parapet.
Viva el narco-sindicalismo and liberty!
Viva nosotros! Andres shouted. Long life to us!
He is a co-religionary of ours, the bomb man said,
and I might have killed him with this.
He looked at the grenade in his hand and was deeply moved as Andres climbed over the parapet. Putting his arms around him, the grenade still in one hand, so that it rested against Andres' shoulder blade as he embraced him, the bomb man kissed him on both cheeks.
I am content that nothing happened to thee, brother, he said. I am very content.
Where is thy officer? Andres asked.
I command here, a man said. Let me see thy papers.
He took them into a dugout and looked at them with the light of a candle. There was the little square of folded silk with the colors of the Republic and the seal of the SIM in the center. There was the salvo conducto, or safe conduct pass, giving his name, age, height, birthplace, and mission that Robert Jordan had written out on a sheet from his notebook and sealed with the SIM rubber stamp. And there were the four folded sheets of the dispatch to Goltz, which were tied around with a cord and sealed with wax, and the impression of the metal SIM seal that was set in the top end of the wooden handle of the rubber stamp.
This I have seen, the man in command of the post said, and handed back the piece of silk. This you all have, I know, but its possession proves nothing without this.
He lifted the salvo conducto and read it through again.
Where were you born?
Via Conejos, Andres said.
And what do they raise there?
Melons,
André said, as all the world knows. Who do you know there? Why, are you from there?
Nay, but I have been there. I am from Aranjuez.
Ask me about anyone.
Describe José Rincón.
Who keeps the bodega?
Naturally.
With a shaved head and a big belly and a cast in one eye.
Then this is valid, the man said, and handed him back the paper.
But what do you do on their side?
Our father had installed himself at Via Castine before the movement, André said, down there beyond the mountains on the plain. It was there we were surprised by the movement. Since the movement I have fought with the band of Pablo, but I am in a great hurry, man, to take that dispatch.
How goes it in the country of the fascists? The man commanding asked. He was in no hurry.
Today we had much tomate, André said proudly. Today there was plenty of dust on the road all day. Today they wiped out the band of Sordo.
And who is Sordo? The other asked deprecatingly.
The leader of one of the best bands in the mountains.
All of you should come into the Republic and join the army, the officer said. There is too much of this silly guerrilla nonsense going on. All of you should come in and submit to our libertarian discipline. Then when we wish to send out guerrillas, we would send them out as they are needed.
Andres was a man endowed with almost supreme patience. He had taken the coming in through the wire calmly. None of this examination had flustered him. He found it perfectly normal that this man should have no understanding of them, nor of what they were doing, and that he should talk idiocy was to be expected. That it should all go slowly should be expected, too. But now he wished to go.
Listen, compadre, he said. It is very possible that you are right, but I have orders to deliver that dispatch to the general commanding the 35th Division, which makes an attack at daylight in these hills, and it is already late at night, and I must go.
What attack? What do you know of an attack?
Nay, I know nothing, but I must go now to Navacerrada and go on from there. Wilt thou send me to thy commander who will give me transport to go on from there? Send one with me now to respond to him that there be no delay.
I distrust all of this greatly, he said. It might have been better to have shot thee as thou approached the wire.
You have seen my papers, comrade, and I have explained my mission, Andres told him patiently.
The papers can be forged, the officer said. Any fascist could invent such a mission. I will go with thee myself to the commander.
Good, Andres said, that you should come, but that we should go quickly.
Thou, Sanchez, thou commandest in my place, the officer said. Thou knowest thy duties as well as I do. I take this so-called comrade to the commander.
They started down the shallow trench behind the crest of the hill, and in the dark Andres smelt the foulness the defenders of the hill crest had made all through the bracken on that slope. He did not like these people who were like dangerous children, dirty, foul, undisciplined, kind, loving, silly, and ignorant, but always dangerous because they were armed. He, Andres, was without politics, except that he was for the Republic. He had heard these people talk many times, and he thought what they said was often beautiful and fine to hear. But he did not like them. It is not liberty not to bury the mess one makes, he thought. No animal has more liberty than the cat, but it buries the mess it makes. The cat is the best anarchist. Until they learn that from the cat, I cannot respect them.
Ahead of him, the officer stopped suddenly. You have your carabine still? He said.
Yes, André said. Why not?
Give it to me, the officer said. You could shoot me in the back with it.
Why? Andres asked him. Why would I shoot thee in the back?
One never knows, the officer said. I trust no one. Give me the carbine.
Andres unslung it and handed it to him.
If it pleases thee to carry it, he said.
It is better, the officer said. We are safer that way.
They went on down the hill in the dark.
Chapter 37. Now Robert Jordan lay with the girl, and he watched time passing on his wrist. It went slowly, almost imperceptibly, for it was a small watch and he could not see the second hand. But as he watched the minute hand, he found he could almost check its motion with his concentration. The girl's head was under his chin, and when he moved his head to look at the watch, he felt the cropped head against his cheek, and it was as soft but as alive and silkily rolling as when a marten's fur rises under the caress of your hand when you spread the trap jaws open and lift the marten clear, and holding it, stroke the fur smooth. His throat swelled when his cheek moved against Maria's hair, and there was a hollow aching from his throat all through him,
as he held his arms around her. His head dropped, his eyes close to the watch, where the lance-pointed, luminous splinter moved slowly up the left face of the dial. He could see its movement clearly and steadily now, and he held Maria close now to slow it. He did not want to wake her, but he could not leave her alone now in this last time, and he put his lips behind her ear and moved them up along her neck, feeling the smooth skin and the soft touch of her hair on them. He could see the hand moving on the watch, and he held her tighter and ran the tip of his tongue along her cheek and onto the lobe of her ear and along the lovely convolutions to the sweet, firm rim at the top, and his tongue was trembling. He felt the trembling run through all of the hollow aching, and he saw the hand of the watch now mounting in sharp angle toward the top where the hour was. Now, while she still slept, he turned her head and put his lips to hers. They lay there, just touching lightly against the sleep-firm mouth, and he swung them softly across it, feeling them brush lightly. He turned himself toward her, and he felt her shiver along the long, light, lovely body, and then she sighed, sleeping, and then she, still sleeping, held him too, and then, unsleeping, her lips were against his, firm and hard and pressing, and he said, "But the pain," and she said, "Nay, there is no pain." "Rabbit." "Nay, speak not." "My rabbit." "Speak not. Speak not." Then they were together, so as the hand on the watch moved, unseen now, they knew that nothing could ever happen to the one that did not happen to the other, that no other thing could happen more than this, that this was all and always. This was what had been, and now, and whatever was to come. This that they were not to have, they were having. They were having now, and before, and always, and now, and now, and now. Oh, now, 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 the only now, and above all now, and there is no other now but thou, now. And now is thy prophet. Now and forever now. Come now. Now, for there is no now but now. Yes, now. Now, please now, only now. Not anything else, only this now. And where are you, and where am I, and where is the other one, and not why, not ever why, only this, now. And on, and always, please, then always now, for now always one, now, one only one. There is no other one but one now, one going now, rising now, sailing now, leaving now, wheeling now, soaring now, away now, all of all the way, now. One and one is one, is one, is one, is one, is still one, is still one, is one descendingly, is one softly, is one longingly, is one kindly, is one happily, is one in goodness, is one to cherish, is one now on earth, with elbows against the cut and slept on branches of the pine tree, with the smell of the pine boughs and the night, to earth conclusively now, and with the morning of the day to come. Then he said, for the other was only in his head, and he had said nothing, "O Maria, I love thee, and I thank thee for this." Maria said, "Do not speak. It is better if we do not speak. I must tell thee, for it is a great thing. Nay, rabbit." But she held him tight and turned her head away, and he asked softly, "Is it pain, rabbit?" "Nay," she said. "It is that I am thankful, too, to have been another time in La Gloria." Then afterwards they lay quiet, side by side, all length of ankle, thigh, hip, and shoulder touching, Robert Jordan now with the watch where he could see it again, and Maria said, "We have had much good fortune." "Yes," he said, "we are people of much luck." "There is not time to sleep?" "No," he said, "it starts soon now." "Then if we must rise, let us go to get something to eat." "All right." Thou art not worried about anything?"
"No."
"Truly?"
"No, not now."
"But thou hast worried before?"
"For a while."
"Is it aught I can help?"
"Nay," he said, "you have helped enough."
"That? That was for me."
"That was for us both," he said. "No one is there alone. Come, rabbit, let us dress." But his mind, that was his best companion, was thinking, "La Gloria." She said, "La Gloria." It has nothing to do with glory, nor la gloire, that the French write and speak about. It is the thing that is in the Cante Hondo,
and in the Saetas. It is in Greco, and in San Juan de la Cruz, of course, and in the others. I am no mystic, but to deny it is as ignorant as though you denied the telephone, or that the